Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Dieter Vanderbroek about his new book, Distinctions in the Flesh, Social Class and the Embodiment of Inequality. So welcome to the podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to you.
This is an incredibly rich and really kind of weighty book, actually. And I think I was saying this before we started recording. On the one hand, it's really readable. I found it really sort of easy to get into. But on the other hand, it does an incredible amount of work ranging across a whole different range of topics that are all brought together around this question of the body. And the place to start would be kind of where did this project come from? Where did this kind of interest in writing about the body as a site for so much sociological reflection come from?
Mm-hmm. Well, the project initially developed out of an interest, as so many kind of people in that day working with Bourdieu and kind of seeing the relevance of Bourdieu for the study of class, but also wanting to take it in new directions. People was a bit of paradigm fatigue, you know, with Bourdieu and the study of class and lifestyle, kind of the same kind of hackneyed topics emerging, you know, music, books, media use. So in many ways, kind of the book started from a bit of what I perceived to be a bit of a double hiatus in the literature. You know, on the one end, it addresses itself to the sociology of the body, which, you know, at the point where I started conceiving the book was a fairly well-established field already, you know, at least since the early 90s. Massive amounts of publications devoted to this topic of the body. But I found when kind of engaging with this literature, quite fascinating to see that there was really a kind of profound lack of reflection on the role of class within that kind of general sociological literature on the body. You very often found that view of what I call in the book the singular body. So it would be the body in consumer culture, or the body in late modernity, or the body under patriarchy. So kind of a generic cast of what the status of the body was in our contemporary age. Or when authors started to look at differentiated views of how bodies operated, there was kind of a very clear focus on gender, ethnicity, and age, but not on class. So in many ways, it was interesting to observe because of feminist scholars, because of scholars in race studies, that the body was put on the map. So it's a very good thing. But compared to kind of looking at gender differences, race differences, even age differences, there wasn't really kind of any pronounced reflection on class. So that was kind of the first angle, positioning myself vis-a-vis the sociology of the body, which lacked kind of any profound reflection on class, but at the same time also turning to people in the field of class research, class analysis, who were increasingly engaging with these issues of taste, lifestyle, the symbolic dimension of class dynamics, but who really weren't paying particular amounts of attention to the body, both empirically, you know, so how do we treat our bodies, how do we clothe our bodies, how do we manage our bodies, feed them, but also conceptually, you know, the kind of the idea that you can't really understand all that much about how class identities are produced and reproduced if you don't take into account that fundamentally embodied nature. So to wrap it up, I think, as the book says, you know, so to kind of highlight the centrality of class for sociologists of the body, and at the same time for sociologists of class to kind of show that embodiment is a core conceptual category that we need to engage with if we want to say anything about, you know, class and inequality in the contemporary age. That kind of summarizes it a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll come back and spend a little bit of time thinking in particular about class and the importance of class. But before that, the other thing in terms of like kind of setting the scene for the book, and you've alluded to this already, is the work of Pierre Bourdieu. And this book, you know, is part of a broader, I don't know whether we call it, you know, a turn or a trend to really pick up on his work. And I wonder if you could kind of sketch maybe both the importance of his work to the book, but actually the importance of his work to kind of like your thought as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, engaging with the body sooner or later, you kind of, you know, you come into touch with the work of Bourdieu. What I found fascinating about that work is how, if you kind of look across the length of his oeuvre, this focus on the socialized body has always been there. So already in the Algerian literature, you see kind of this role of embodiment in thinking about Kabyle identity, Kabyle gender identity, but also like in his very early work in his own, you know, native region of Béarn, where he's talking about the Béarn peasantry, kind of already showing that how peasant identity is a fundamentally embodied identity, which doesn't necessarily exist at the level of discourse or representation or consciousness, but is very much located at the level of posture, accent, pronunciation, those things. So, you know, really long before like the body and embodiment became these very fashionable topics of sociological theorizing, he was already highlighting their importance for thinking about the social world in general. The book was really about taking that up. I mean, the problem is a bit that, you know, Bourdieu's remarks on the body are kind of dispersed throughout his oeuvre. So it was kind of this already this idea to kind of bring them together and put them to a bit more of a systematic empirical test. The book itself really, in many ways, kind of takes the analytical framework developed in Distinction, hence the title Distinctions in the Flesh, taking that framework and kind of applying it to contemporary forms of body management, body work. What Bourdieu, I think, allows us to do conceptually is two important things that Bourdieu has probably gone furthest. And I say in the book, I mean, he's not the first to think about these issues. I mean, you can find very similar reflections in, you know, the work of Merleau-Ponty, Dewey, Edward Sapir. So Bourdieu is definitely not being in entirely novel, but I think what Bourdieu probably where he went furthest is in helping us think through the body and its kind of dual reality, as at once that thing that we use to navigate the social world. It's kind of the basis of our perception, of our classifications. Bourdieu spends ample time arguing that we don't, you know, our relationship to the world is not a mental relationship. We don't judge it purely in intellectual terms. We react to that world physically, you know, desire, disgust, those are kind of profoundly visceral emotions. So on the one hand, there is that focus, this habitus as being kind of the seat of our classifications, our way of relating to that world. But also at the same time, the body is kind of as bearing, as reflecting kind of our position in social space, our trajectory through social space. So in many ways, the body is being as a physical realization of class. And I think for me, Bourdieu has probably gone furthest in at once tackling that dual reality. The body is classifying, but the body is also classified. And then kind of linking that up to kind of the developed sense of social class, which probably sets him apart from earlier ideas that you can find, also ideas related to habitus, as you find it in the work of people like Robert Elias or Marcel Mauss, you know, his predecessor. So yeah, I think for me, that embodied dimension in Bourdieu's work to kind of bring that out and put that to, not just to kind of, you know, theorize about it, but to kind of put it to the empirical test. I think that was kind of the key for me.
That actually sets up quite neatly the the way the book is structured, with essentially, you know, kind of a book of three parts, really, that, that doesn't have an exact divide between theory and empirical testing. But, but there is, you know, a kind of a set of balances between the different sections. And I guess you've gestured already to much of what the front end of the book does in terms of the theoretical work. And I wonder if we could maybe take two ideas just to kind of round up the theory sections. And one would be this kind of question about, I guess, kind of like a view of class that is relational, that is about emotions, and is about kind of sets of practices, which is really the topic, the second chapter. And then also, you know, the relationship between class bodies and times, which is chapter three. So I wonder if you could, yeah, just do a little bit of kind of sketching, really, on those two chapters.
Well, I mean, the first kind of, as you point out, kind of the theoretical section sets itself a couple of goals, but the main impetus there is kind of, okay, let's take this proposition that social class is embodied and draw out the full implications of that, you know, that statement for sociology. You know, in what senses can we say that social class is embodied? And I think the book really kind of takes that into three distinct directions, some of which I've already talked about. You know, first of all, class is embodied in the phenomenological sense, the sense that people like Merleau-Ponty would use to say, you know, that the core fundamental aspects of class identity are not situated at the level of class consciousness, you know, are not situated at the level of language and discourse, but are fundamentally, you know, exist in the embodied form. You know, we learn what it means to be part of a class through our body. It's much more a knowing how than a knowing that, to borrow Ryle's infamous opposition. So really, the first idea is class is embodied in a phenomenological sense. You know, we learn class through the body. Class exists at the level of sensory motor skills, the way in which we talk, the way in which we shake hands, the way in which we eat, our posture, pronunciation, those types of things. But there's also kind of a second, more fundamental way in which in a quite literal way, I argue, in the book, in which class is embodied, and that is really our bodies are kind of marked physically by our position in social space. That's a Bourdieusian argument, but it actually goes back a lot further if you look at, for instance, Irving Goffman's very first published paper, where he makes that precise argument that he says, you know, a lot of what class is can be faked. You know, you can fake an accent, you can fake certain gestures and certain ways of acting, but in many ways the body is the most genuine, the most authentic realization of our class. You know, the complexion of our skin, our posture, our length, our size, you know, the condition of our hands, our teeth, all of those things kind of, you know, betray our position in social space. So that's kind of the second thing I bring up in the book, you know, that in many ways, yeah, class is embodied in a quite literal sense. You know, it exists in our physical sizes and shapes, in our physical qualities. And then the third point, which I hadn't really found a lot about in profound theorizing about in the literature up to that point is kind of this idea that embodiment is a universal existential condition. And by that I mean, you know, you and I, Dave, we are different in many ways, and we are different because we have very distinct social trajectories and we speak different languages. You know, we probably have different tastes in what do we know, that are all linked because to the fact that we have distinct social experiences. But underneath all those differences that social life has inscribed in our bodies, we are at the end of the day biological beings, and we are radically similar in the fact that, you know, we need to breathe air, we need to eat and drink. From that it follows that we will probably need to defecate, that, you know, we will need to sleep at one point or another. So our bodies kind of lock us in a universal shared condition, and that's kind of what the book tries to show, is that the body is in many ways an important leveling principle, you know, that positions people as radically equal. And the body in many ways also challenges class differences. You know, I draw on historical sources here. Mikhail Bakhtin, who writes about the world of Rabelais, how lower class imagery has always used the body to kind of challenge and subvert dominant hierarchies, to show that the powerful also have to poop, you know, and they also kind of share a body with the least powerful. So I kind of focus on that aspect of it, you know, how in many ways, if you want to study processes of class distinction and symbolic distinction, then the body is a very rewarded case, because our bodies are kind of a constant testimony to the fact that we are different. You know, the fact that we live in a body means that we are equally prone to injury, to illness, that we are equally mortal, those things. So kind of those were kind of the three major points I draw out in starting from this proposition to say that social class is embodied, which is kind of the topic of the second chapter, which aims to set that out.
And also, I mean, the book sort of wonderfully, you know, kind of almost sort of straightforwardly illustrates these questions about embodiment, and, you know, it kind of brings in the discussion of time a bit as well when it thinks through its empirical examples. So, you know, questions about obesity, food consumption, sport, which is the kind of center of the book. And I wonder if we might think through some of the theoretical discussions with, for instance, the sociology of obesity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the way the book is set up, as you say, kind of I outlined the conceptual work on embodiment in class, and then use a number of empirical cases to kind of illustrate that. The chapter on obesity is not necessarily a chapter on obesity per se. It's more a chapter on weight differences and how body weight is a very nice case to help us illustrate that kind of recursive relationship between class and bodies. This idea that physical differences are in a lot of ways shaped by class differences, but physical differences in turn help to kind of naturalize and legitimize these class differences. And one of the very interesting cases there is body weight. And again, here sociology was profoundly lacking behind other disciplines. And in that chapter, I excessively engage with social epidemiology. We have been showing over at least over the past couple of decades, you know, that our body weight, the size and shape of our bodies, is fundamentally impacted by our social position. In fact, you know, that the probability of being, you know, of being obese, of being overweight, that probability increases dramatically as you lower in the social hierarchy. So that, you know, I argue in the book that women with a master's degree, with a postgraduate degree, are, you know, 20 times less likely to be rated as obese than women who have little or no formal education. So this idea that body weight is innate, that it's a genetic thing, that really doesn't hold up to the empirical data. And at the same time, kind of as you rise in the social hierarchy, the probability that people have kind of this ideal body, that increases dramatically. But also kind of getting to define what is an ideal body is fundamentally a class aspect. You know, in Western society, there's a clear negative relationship between class position and body weight. So the higher your social status, the lower your weight tends to be. And, you know, a lot of the global South, you know, that opposition is inverse. You know, like as you rise in the social hierarchy, people become increasingly larger. So the kind of getting to define what is, you know, beautiful, what is the ideal body, that is fundamentally class linked. Why do I focus on weight stigmatization? I think because in many ways weight stigmatization is kind of a quintessentially modern or quintessentially neoliberal form of class racism. You know, what sets weight stigmatization and weight discrimination apart from other forms of discrimination, racism, sexism, and so forth, is that, you know, the overweight are held responsible for their own stigmatization. You know, well, if you're stigmatized on the basis of your weight, then just go on a diet. You know, it's not that hard. You know, if you don't want to be stigmatized, if you don't want to be discriminated, then eat less. You know, it's kind of this idea that in contemporary societies, being fat is just not wanting to be thin. When you have kind of 4,000 options to gain the ideal body, then you're not just doing your best. And for me, it was kind of illustrating that dual relationship, showing how class contributes to shaping the physicality of our body, but in turn, how kind of that physicality helps naturalize class. So the idea that, you know, poor people have a disproportionate probability of being overweight. The overweight are generally perceived as being unmotivated, you know, lazy, not that smart. So put two and two together, then maybe, you know, the poor are poor because they're just lazy and unmotivated. You know, it's kind of that basic argument, which is remarkably widespread. And I get confronted with that, you know, on a, every day when you kind of start reading about these things, that kind of weight stigmatization is kind of a concealed form of class racism. Class racism in the book spends, you know, ample time engaging with that.
Yeah, and you know, it's very different to some of the examples that chapter starts with, actually, of, you know, 100, 200 years previous, where the relationship is almost actually inverted between, you know, the kind of the expressions of corpulence and wealth, now kind of manifesting themselves as essentially sort of territories for stigmatization, for, you know, expressions of disgust, and as you say, you know, a kind of profound individualization of what are essentially kind of social manifestations of how things like food production is organized, how, you know, the kind of like the daily routine and you know, kind of opportunities for expressions of lifestyle are organized. I mean, the thing that's interesting there is the profound sense of, I guess, kind of obvious divisions that, you know, you can see in almost kind of like everyday media discussions and stuff like that. But the chapter on food, I think, is perhaps a little more subtle, because, you know, there is the sense of kind of everybody eats, you know, like, and the kind of questions of what we eat and how we eat are still, you know, kind of sites for contestation and, you know, to use the Borgesian language, sites for distinction. But perhaps the kind of, you know, the questions of the manner of eating are perhaps a little more subtle. And I was especially interested in that chapter.
Again, yeah, you're, as you set it up quite well, I think food is maybe being the quintessential domain for studying processes of distinction, because perhaps nothing illustrates more dramatically and more visibly our kind of our common universal embodiment. We all have to eat, and so eating is kind of this very visible reminder of our physicality, of our viscerality, and I argue in the book that it's perhaps, you know, because of that food is so incredibly socially polarized. I opened the chapter with a quote by two fairly renowned biologists who say, you know, it's just a blatant, you know, falsification of reality to say that people are omnivores. You know, it's that idea that food tastes are so incredibly polarized. So I use that chapter to kind of illustrate the kind of profound opposition between this instrumental relationship to the body that you see at the bottom of social space. People have used their bodies as a tool, as an instrument, as a source of labor power, and hence also orient their food practices on that basis. Look at food mainly in terms of its capacity to fill, to feed, but also to provide kind of a primal source of pleasure. You know, I argue at length that, you know, in conditions of precarity, food is actually one of those very few luxuries that people have. I was reading and rereading Annette Leroux's Unequal Childhoods, and I was kind of struck by the fact that, you know, even in poor families, there's at birthdays, there's very little money for physical gifts. But one of the things that, you know, people don't save up on is food. At least we can give that, you know. So this primary form of pleasure, this primary form of nurturing. And as you kind of go up in the social hierarchy, you see kind of these more formal aspects of food that start to come into play. So in the book, I use kind of a variety of sources, people's opinions on food. I kind of make fairly detailed analysis of people's food consumption patterns. I look at their judgment of particular dishes. But as you say in the interview and in the question as well, as you set it up, it's not just about what people eat. It's also fundamentally about how people eat. So a lot of practices you can't really understand if you just look at the pricing of food and its cost at those things. But also you have to look at the way in which particular food is eaten. You know, in the book, I make this equation between masculinity and mastication. You know, why is beef, why is red meat still consumed so much, you know, by the working classes? It's also, you know, it's a very masculine type of meat. You know, it's a meat that requires strength to eat. It just does not just give strength, but it, you know, it requires strength to eat. The same thing with bananas as opposed to grapes, for instance, which you have to pick with your fingers, which are kind of, you know, which are kind of more feminine. So you have to take into account, you know, that food is not just about feeding the body. You also use your body to eat food. And there are more or less, you know, classified ways, classed ways of eating that I kind of bring out in the book as well. And one of the final things I kind of try to demonstrate how food tastes are incredibly durable. So one of the things I do in the book, I make an analysis of upwardly mobile people, those who climb in the social hierarchy mainly through their academic success. And I show that, you know, even those who kind of, you know, were at the top of the social hierarchy, in many ways kind of have internalized dominant tastes. When you kind of look at their food preferences, they still kind of, you know, harken back to their primary social milieu. So that's quite interesting to see that, you know, food is this kind of, in many ways, our food tastes are our primary form of social conditioning, you know, the first forms of socialization, and those tend to stick with us for a fairly long time, and they are quite hard to transform. Contra this narrative, you know, that, you know, it's easy to change your lifestyle, it's easy to change your food tastes. I argue in that chapter on food in particular that it's in fact quite hard to kind of shake those things off. So yeah, those are kind of the different stakes I try to tackle in the chapter on food.
I think it's really important, actually, that you've sort of touched on and gestured towards gender there, and obviously, you know, Budget and the Budgesian canon often gets into quite problematic discussions when questions of gender are raised, and there are very, you know, positions on Budget's approach to gender, and sport actually might be quite a nice way to think through the question of where gender figures in your analysis, because of the kind of really obvious, or at least superficially obvious, divisions around sport and gender. And actually, I wonder if this might be a good kind of moment to kind of raise the question of gender for your analysis.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I don't think you point out about, you know, people who kind of follow Bourdieu's reasoning, and then there's some problematic relationship to gender. Is definitely something I wanted to tackle in the book. When you deal with issues of the body, whereas other topics may allow Bourdieu sociologists to kind of skate around this topic of gender, I think here you kind of have to confront it head on, which is not an easy task. I think you can kind of, you know, to tie the two together, and I'm still not completely convinced that I managed to pull it off completely. But what I tend to argue in the book is that our judgments of class are profoundly sexual in nature. So I spent, I think, a considerable part of the first chapter showing how the basic oppositions of class, the oppositions between, you know, upper class status and lower class status, but also the oppositions between, you know, cultural elites and the opposition between economics elites, those are kind of profoundly gendered oppositions. So in many ways, our judgments of class are always fundamentally inflected with sexual values. So one of the things I argue, following on insights developed by people like Paul Willis, for instance, is that our judgments of class, when, for instance, the working class looks upwards towards the top of social space, they tend to see the upper classes in feminine terms. Willis has this infamous argument that he makes that, you know, the lads that he studies use kind of the sexual division of labor as a means of kind of legitimizing their own position in the class division of labor, and they take this mental versus manual opposition, and they in a sense subvert that hierarchy by degrading the mental as being feminine. It's something, you know, that women do. That's not for real men. Real men are engaged with the world of manual labor, monopolize the field of manual labor, and use kind of manual labor as a source of identity, a positive source of identity. And when they look up towards men who are situated up higher in social space, they see they're not real men. You know, they're pencil pushers. They don't really, you know, they're at the end of the day, they're too feminine. And the other way around, when upper classes look down social space and they look at the working class, and they look, for instance, at working class women, they imbue working class women with qualities that are, you know, considered masculine. They're loud, they're aggressive, they're vulgar, they're unfeminine. So it's basically that idea of how class is really fundamentally always kind of imbued with sexual undertones. And one of the domains where you see that quite clearly is the domain of sports. So it's no big secret that as you kind of rise in the social hierarchy, the gender ratios of different types of sports become more balanced. You know, the elements of competition, of confrontation, and of direct physical contact, you know, those masculine elements of sports become increasingly euphemized. You know, conflict becomes euphemized. The players are no longer in direct contact with each other. Sports at the top of the social hierarchy are slightly more balanced between men and women, whereas at the bottom of social space, sports still kind of really have that strong masculine imperative. So it's a tricky topic, and I kind of shy away from trying to wrap, you know, summarize it in about, you know, 5 minutes. But in many ways, the book argues that you can't all of the basic oppositions that we use to talk about class, you know, distinguished versus vulgar, you know, refined versus, you know, uncapped, those kind of things, those basic oppositions, those basic symbolic oppositions, they're not only classed, they're fundamentally gendered. And it's very hard in everyday practice to kind of separate out in our judgments about the social world, which parts are, you know, which parts are class-based and which parts are kind of, which parts are due to the sexual division of labor. So I argue that even though there's two distinct mechanisms at play, so on one hand, you kind of have the mechanism of distinction, whereby those who are high in social status try to, you know, separate themselves from the vulgar, you know, the unrefined, and kind of turn towards feminine qualities in doing that. And then on the other hand, you have kind of this logic of sexual domination that tends to, you know, associate women with the refined, with the cultivated, and, you know, sees men with a rough and tumble of social life. Even those are two distinct mechanisms. In everyday practice, we kind of, the schematics that we use to perceive and judge the social world, the basic oppositions are always overdetermined socially and sexually, as a very clumsy response to that question.
I mean, it's funny this, because all the way through, there's been some relationship to power and domination in all of the things we've been discussing. But obviously the kind of explicit discussion of this is something that comes towards the end of the book, you know, and I certainly in my reading, the kind of the last three chapters of the book really are about this question of, as you say, you know, not just the kind of the making of distinction, but also the questions of, you know, explicit power and domination, you know, social control, these kinds of things. And I wonder if I could pick up on one really tiny, quite boring kind of example that you use, which is about secondhand clothes, which I thought was like just such a kind of, you know, brilliant sort of illustration of this question about, you know, the power to kind of set what is an acceptable look for the body, how, you know, seemingly the same set of objects, you know, secondhand clothes, are kind of used very, very differently by powerful groups who can, you know, set a kind of a tone and a category of the acceptable versus how it's used by the dominated.
Absolutely. Well, I think the case of secondhand clothing is an interesting case, because there you kind of see how, as you say, the similar, an obviously similar practice, or like a seemingly similar practice, gets invested with quite opposing meanings. You know, for there's two groups that kind of identify as being the main consumers of of secondhand clothing. It's really those at the bottom of social space, where it's a question of necessity, you know, of going to secondhand clothing stores and finding kind of the items that are least dated, that look the newest, you know, that show the least signs of wear, that are kind of, you know, fashionable in the sense, you know, that they go with kind of modern mass consumer fashion, as you find in H&M and Primark or what have you. So for the working classes, it's finding the clothing that's, you know, that's most similar to what the current trend says. Whereas at the top of social space, especially towards, you know, the cultural pull of social space, you see kind of this logic of distinction, where it's no longer finding clothing that shows the least sign of wear. It's in many ways finding clothing with the most signs of wear and items that are unique, that are vintage, that are authentic, you know, that are that go away from kind of mass consumerism and that kind of these finding these unique pieces, hunting for these unique pieces, which the logic of dating and of aging has made unique. So it's quite interesting to see that, you know, this secondhand clothing store, you know, becomes a site of quite different aesthetic practices. For one group, the taste of necessity dictates that you find clothing which looks the least worn, and for other groups, it's really about, you know, about distinguishing yourself, finding pieces that are unique, that are obviously not expensive, you know, that kind of are in many ways as opposed to working class taste, or as they are opposed to kind of the taste of, you know, the economic elites with their conspicuous consumption, their luxury brands. You know, it's very much about finding those authentic pieces that are unique, and about, you know, showing your own aesthetic sensibility by displaying those types of pieces. And more general, you see that, you know, and this is kind of the relational element, is that, you know, tastes only signal because they position themselves towards different groups. And you see that, and I use this example of the cultural elite in many cases, in the domain of food, in the domain of clothing, where you can see that these groups are, as opposed to, you know, working class tastes, which are seen as, you know, mass consumers and vulgar, unrefined, but also towards, you know, the tastes of economic elites, which, you know, with their conspicuous consumption and their luxury consumption, you know, their superficial materialism. So you see that in tastes in food, which tend to be, you know, ascetic, gluten-free, vegan, vegetarian, you know, as opposed to kind of the haute cuisine of the, you know, of the rich fat cats, as the kind of, you know, the McDonald's diet of the working classes. And the basic argument is you only understand or fully understand those practices when you apply this relational reading to them. That's kind of the key argument I want to make here.
I mean, that's a kind of bigger challenge you've got, I think, for sociology itself in the book, actually, you know. And, and one of the things I quite liked, I mean, this, you know, sort of related to the things I'm interested in, so it's unsurprising I quite liked it, was the sense of, you know, subverting or challenging the hierarchies, not just of a kind of, you know, mind body, masculine feminine, theoretical practical set of divisions, but also challenging the sense of, you know, there are grand proper themes for sociological research around, you know, political economy or whatever, and then, you know, eating or fashion are somehow frivolous. And actually, you know, what we should be doing to understand the social is seeing, you know, questions of political economy or class distinction, questions of power and domination in these, you know, seemingly kind of frivolous ideas. And I think that, you know, might be quite a nice point to kind of conclude on the book, actually, your sort of challenge for doing an analysis of the social properly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that's the point that I end the book on as well, is kind of starting from this. And this is really an inherently fundamental aspect to Bourdieu's work, I think, that hasn't always been properly picked up by people who have applied Bourdieu subsequently. I think this idea that as sociologists, whether we like it or not, we have kind of these intellectual hierarchies in our head, these intellectual taxonomies, and that those kind of often prevent us from seeing exactly what you point out to, that central issues of class, of power, of political organization, they're not limited to the sphere of the political, to the sphere of the labor market, to the sphere of the state, but they do manifest themselves in things like everyday practices. And it's really kind of those those hierarchies which are, you know, profoundly classist, profoundly sexist in nature. You know, it's men who get to study the grand serious themes, whereas, you know, you have these frivolous subdisciplines, sociology of food, sociology of the body, which are kind of, you know, often viewed pejoratively. Whereas I argue in the book that we need to kind of profoundly subvert those hierarchies and profoundly rethink those, because things like class domination, you know, the imposition of dominant lifestyles, even things like neoliberalism cannot be fully understood unless you realize that neoliberalism is also at work in things like, you know, dieting and weight discrimination, you know, this discourse of personal responsibility, of having to, you know, to live up to your own standards, to be responsible for yourself. Those things are very much present in things like the modern dieting and fitness industry. Whereas we are quick to recognize those things in the sphere of the political, where they're already constituted as being political. We're not as quick to recognize them in the sphere of something like body management and dieting, where they have a profound political impact, because if the working class starts, you know, mimicking this discourse of personal responsibility, of you know, individual choice and individual self-reliance, which are very much promoted through things like the contemporary fashion diet and body industry, then that has profound political impact. And as you say, I think, you know, because we are wedded to these kind of these hierarchies, these distinctions, and sociology in general, is that very often prevents us from realizing that, yes, the personal is the political, you know, and there's more to that statement than you know, and the way in which it is usually positioned. And I think fundamentally the book is about that, about showing that, you know, that politics, that power operates in things that are generally, you know, brushed off as being purely cosmetic. And there is more to weight discrimination, to food tastes, to the sports that we practice, than simple lifestyle choices and simple individual choices. And they have their role to play in understanding power. And I think I really end the book on saying that, you know, a contemporary analysis of power, a contemporary analysis of domination, really profoundly needs a sociology of the body, a critical sociology of the body to engage with. So, yeah.
I mean, there's like loads more we could have talked about in the book, you know, even just, you know, from the kind of concluding chapters around questions of sexuality. We could have talked more about body image. There are questions, of course, about, you know, kind of resistance, you know, the I suppose the kind of, you know, classic Foucauldian sort of positioning towards Bourdieu about, you know, well, what about how people are resisting these positions in social space. But as a kind of concluding question, And to gesture actually to some of the things we haven't talked about, what are you sort of working on now? And you know, are you kind of like developing some of the themes and distinctions in the flesh? Or are you, you know, completely ignoring your own advice and just getting into heavy political economy?
Still haven't engaged with the political economy. No, I'm in many ways I'm moving away from this topic of the body, but I am staying with this problem that's in many ways at the core of the book, and which is for me the problem of classification. So classification, but the question of how do people, you know, judge the world around them is fundamentally structured in terms of class, and the book argues that, you know, of course the body plays a fundamental role in that. We use bodies, we use physical appearance to judge each other's social position, to judge each other's character, and my current work is picking up on that theme, but casts that entire idea in a fundamentally developmental perspective. So I'm currently looking at how, whereas in the book I ask people to judge adult bodies, I ask adults to judge adult bodies in terms of class status. What I'm doing now is kind of delving into this question of, okay, how does this process start? You know, when do young children start developing this sense for class differences? So I pick up this problem of classification and I kind of start looking at how preschoolers start already developing a sense of which styles of clothing, which types of bodies are related to particular types of status. So no political economy, political economy of childhood, as it were. And yeah, a lot of disillusioning findings about, you know, the innocence of children who don't turn out to be all that innocent when you start delving into their class issues. Who knows, in a couple of years, we'll have a book.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I was talking to Vanderbrook about distinctions in the flesh, social class, and the importance of it.